bullied himself upright. He pulls on his Scooter Depot work clothes, then sneak-foots along the upstairs hall to listen at the top of the stairs. She must be in the kitchen. There are food smells and clinkings. He descends gingerly, peers around the doorframe. She's sitting at the kitchen table texting on her phone, a plate of tousled breakfast leftovers in front of her. She's wearing her I Mean Business outfit, tidy suit, gold earrings, the gray stockings. Her reading glasses are perched on her nose. No cake. No goon. Nothing out of the ordinary. "Sleep in?" Jocelyn says pleasantly. Should he say, "Happy Valentine's Day," then advance and give her a kiss to forestall any nastiness? Maybe not. Maybe she's forgotten what day it is. "Yeah," he says. "Bad dreams?" "I don't dream," he says, lying. "Everyone dreams," she says. "Have an egg, or two. I poached them for you. They might be a little hard. Coffee's in the thermos." She turns the two eggs out onto a piece of toast. They've been done in heart-shaped poachers. Is this the Valentine's surprise? Is this all? He feels massive relief. "Get real, Stan," he tells himself. "She's not so bad. All she wanted was a bit of fun, plus getting back at her lech of a husband." She's looking at him to see his reaction. "Thanks," he says. "That's nice. It's a nice gesture." She gives one of her all-teeth smiles. She isn't deceived for an instant. She knows he hates this. "You're welcome," she says. "A token of my appreciation." A tip for the houseboy. Demeaning. He needs to wolf down the food, then beat it out of the house. Hightail it down to the Scooter Depot. Make small talk. Rewire some circuits. Hit something with a hammer. Take a breather. "I'm a bit late for work," he says, to prepare her for his rapid exit. He slabs one of the eggs into his mouth, squeezes it down. "You won't be going to your job today," she says in a neutral voice. "You'll be coming with me in the car." The room darkens. "Why?" he says. "What's up?" "I suggest you eat that other egg," she says, smiling. "You'll need the energy. You're going to have a long day."
"Why is that?"
he says as calmly as he can. He peers down over the edge of the next half hour. Mist. A sheer drop. He feels sick. She's poured herself a coffee. She's leaning in across the table.
"The cameras are off, but not for long," she says. "So I'm going to tell you this very quickly."
Her manner has changed completely. Gone is the awkward flirtation, the dominatrix pose. She's urgent, straightforward.
"Forget everything you think you know about me. And by the way, you kept your cool very well during our time together. I know I'm not your favorite squeeze toy, but you would have fooled most, which is why I'm asking you to do this, because I think you can."
She pauses, eyeing him. Stan swallows.
"Do what?" he says.
"Lie, steal, inflict wounds. Connor things? Something from the Shadowlands? It has that feel."
"We need to smuggle somebody to the outside. Outside the consilience wall," she says. "I've already switched your database entries. You've been Phil these past months, but now you're going to be Stan again, just for a few hours. Then after that, we can get you out."
Stan feels dizzy.
"Out?" he says. "How?"
"Nobody gets out unless they're upper management."
"Never mind how. Think of yourself as a messenger. I need you to take some information out."
"Just a minute," says Stan.
"What's going on? Who's we?"
"Ed's right about some things," says Jocelyn. "You heard him on the town meeting. There really are some folks who want to expose the project, but they aren't all out there. Some of them are in here. In fact, some of them are in this room."
She smiles.
Now her smile has an almost elfish quality. Dangerous, though this conversation must be, she's enjoying it.
"Whoa, just a minute," says Stan. "This is too much in one soundbite."
"How come?
I thought you were part of the top management in this place. You're high up in surveillance, right?"
"I am. As a matter of fact, I'm Ed's founding partner. I supported the project in the early stages. I believed in it. I believed in Ed. I worked hard on it. I thought it was for the best," says Jocelyn. "I bought the good news story. And it was true at first, considering the alternative, which was a terrible life for a lot of people. But then Ed brought in a different group of investors, and they got greedy."
"Greedy about what?" says Stan. "It's not like this place makes a profit. On the fucking Brussels sprouts? And the chickens? I thought it was more about saving money, or like a charity thing, right?"
Jocelyn sighs.
"You don't honestly believe this whole operation is being run simply to rejuvenate the Rust Belt and create jobs? That was the original idea, but once you've got a controlled population with a wall around it and no oversight, you can do anything you want. You start to see the possibilities, and some of those got very profitable very fast."
Stan can hardly follow.
"I guess the building contractors must be making..."
"Forget the contracting end," says Jocelyn. "It's a sideshow. The main deal is the prison. Prisons used to be about punishment and then reform and penitence, and then keeping dangerous offenders inside. Then, for quite a few decades, they were about crowd control, pinning up the young, aggressive, marginalized guys to keep them off the streets. And then, when they started to be run as private businesses, they were about the profit margins for the prepackaged jail meal suppliers and the hired guards and so forth."
Stan nods. He understands all of this.
"But when we signed on," he says, "it wasn't like that. They didn't lie about what we'd have inside. We got the house, we got... Before we were broke, we were miserable. In here we were a lot happier."
"Of course you were," says Jocelyn. "At first... So was I at the beginning. But this isn't the beginning anymore."
"What's the bad news then?" says Stan.
"Suppose I told you about the income from body parts. Organs, bones, DNA, whatever's in demand. That's one of the big earners for this place. It was going on in other countries first, and they were making a killing. That aspect was too tempting for Ed. There's a big market for transplant material among aging millionaires, no? Ed's bought into a retirement home chain, and he set up the transplant clinics right inside each of the branch facilities. Ruby Slippers retirement homes and clinics. It's big. The main operation is in Las Vegas, for the cutting edge. He figures there'll be less scrutiny there, because anything goes. He doesn't miss a trick."
"Just a minute," says Stan. "Whose body parts? It's still the same number of guys in Positron. I know them. They're not being sliced up for organs. It's not as if anyone's vanishing."
"Not once we got rid of the real criminals."
"Yes, Ed thinks it's a shame we ran out of those," says Jocelyn. "He's got plans to import some more, take them off the hands of the public, so to speak. But your guys are the good citizens of Consilience. They keep the place running day to day. They're the worker ants. They'll stay in place. The raw material's being shipped in from outside. The truck. The hooded, shuffling prisoners."
"Oh, great," thinks Stan. "We're stuck in a grainy, black-and-white, retro-thriller movie."
"You mean they're rounding people up, carting them here? Killing them for parts?"
"Just undesirables," says Jocelyn, smiling with her big teeth. She's kept some of her badass sarcasm, anyway. "But now undesirable is whoever Ed says. Ed says the next hot thing is going to be baby's blood, by the way. It's being talked up as very rejuvenating for the elderly, and the margin on that is going to be astronomical."
"That's..." Stan wants to say, "fucking gruesome," which doesn't begin to cover it. Or else he could say, "You're shitting me." But he remembers that thing he heard about the mouse experiments. Also, she seems deadly serious. "Where are they planning on getting the babies?"
"There's no shortage," she says, with that other smile of hers, the ironic one. "People leave them lying around. So careless."
"Has anyone heard about this?" he says.
Out there? Have they put it together? Shouldn't they?
That's what Ed's worried about, says Jocelyn. That's why the ultra-tight security. A few rumors were circulating, but he's managed to shut them down. Now nobody connected with a news outlet can get within a mile of this place. And as you know, no information is allowed out. That's why we have to send a person such as you. You'll be taking a digitized document dump and some videos on a flash drive. We'll try to set you up with a key media target. Someone who's not pals with Ed's political friends and who's willing to take a chance on breaking the story.
So I'm supposed to be what? Says Stan. The errand boy? The one who gets shot, he thinks.
More or less, says Jocelyn.
Why don't you take it out yourself, this document dump?
Jocelyn looks at him pityingly. No way, she says. It's true, I have a pass, I can go out. I've been setting up the outside operations, paying off the people we hire to do the less legal things Ed's got us involved in. But I'm monitored the whole time. To make sure I stay safe is Ed's excuse. He trusts me as far as he trusts anyone. But increasingly, that's not much. He's getting jumpy.
Why didn't you make a break for it? Just get out, says Stan. It's most likely what he himself would have done.
I helped build this, says Jocelyn. I need to help fix it. Now, time's up. We have to move.
Sandbag. They're in the car now. He can scarcely remember walking out to it. In front of them, there's a driver. A real one, not a robot. The driver sits upright, his gray shoulders straight, the back of his head non-committal. The streets glide past.
Where are we going? Says Stan.
Positron, says Jocelyn. Our exit strategy for you begins there. Need to get you prepped, then see you through the day. This move is not without risks. It would be very unfortunate if you got caught.
The driver, thinks Stan.
It's always the driver, in movies. Listening in. Spying on everyone.
What about him? He says.
He's heard all this. Oh, that's only Phil, says Jocelyn. Or Max. You'll recognize him from the videos.
Phil turns around, gives a brief smile. It's him, all right. Charmaine's Max, with his handsome, narrow, untrustworthy face, his two bright eyes.
He's been such a help in creating motive, says Jocelyn. We chose Charmaine because we thought she might be...
susceptible, says Phil.
Sufficient to have stood, but free to fall, says Jocelyn.
What?
Says Stan. This is some slur on Charmaine. He clenches his fists. Steady, he tells himself.
She was a gamble, says Jocelyn.
But she paid off, says Phil.
The lying bastard. He wasn't even sincere, thinks Stan. He was shitting poor Charmaine all along. Setting her up. Leading her astray from motives different from the ones you're supposed to have when you lead someone astray. It's as if Charmaine wasn't good enough for him. Not good enough for a genuine, illicit passion. Which, if you think about it, is actually a criticism of Stan. His hands are burning. He'd like to strangle the guy, or at least give him a solid punch in the teeth.
Motive for what? Says Stan.
Don't be sulky, says Jocelyn. For why I'd want to have you eliminated. I have superiors. I'll need to account to them for my decision.
Eliminated? You're going to do what?
Stan almost shouts. This is getting more demented by the minute. Underneath the heroic talk, is she a psychopath after all? With designs on his liver as a bonus?
Whatever you want to call it, says Jocelyn. Among our management group, we call it repurposing. I have the discretionary power for that,
and I've made those kinds of decisions before, when things have gone seriously... when I've had to. For this particular scenario, the one geared toward getting you past the wall in one piece, anyone likely to be checking up on me, such as Ed, knows power corrupts. They'll have experienced that firsthand. They'll see how I'd be tempted to use my own power for personal reasons. They may not approve of that, but they'll buy it. The evidence is all there, supposing I might ever need to use it, which I hope I won't.
Such as? Says Stan. Evidence?
He's feeling cold all over and a little dizzy. It's on record, every minute of it. Everything you'd need to establish a reason. Phil and Charmaine, their torrid affair, which I have to say Phil threw himself into, but he's good at that.
Then my own degrading and jealous attempts to reenact that affair and punish Charmaine through you. Why do you think we had to go through all that theatrical sex in front of the TV?
Your reluctance was fully registered, believe me. The lighting was good. I've seen the clips.
She sighs.
I was a little surprised you didn't take a swipe at me. A lot of men would have. And I know you almost lost it a couple of times. I worried about your blood pressure. But you've shown impressive restraint.
Thanks, says Stan. He has a moment of pleasure at having been tagged impressive. Cripes, he tells himself. Are you buying this? Do you believe for one nanosecond that this stone-cold bitch wasn't getting off big time on treating you like a fucking galley slave? Do you trust the two of them?
No, he answers. But do you have any choice?
Pull back. Say you won't do it, and they'll likely kill you.
It was a plus that you had to force yourself, says Jocelyn.
Your reluctance played well, though it was hardly flattering. Anyone watching would conclude it was sex at virtual gunpoint.
She's not really like that underneath. She can be very attractive, says Phil gallantly.
Or maybe even honestly, thinks Stan.
Tastes differ.
I agree, he says, because agreement is called for. It was hardly at gunpoint. It was...
Jocelyn crosses her legs. She pats Stan's thigh as if steadying him.
Anyway, those who might have to be shown those videos will see why I might want to get rid of you. And by means of Charmaine, for, after all, she filched my husband, right? Double punishment. It has to be watertight, this stunt. Something that can fool Ed, supposing he'll go looking. He'd buy that kind of malice coming from me. He thinks I'm hard-ass as it is. That's why I'm his right-hand gal.
Is this leading where Stan thinks?
His hands are clammy.
What stunt?
The part where Charmaine goes into work in medications administration, where on a normal day she administers an exit dose to someone slated for repurposing, and then finds out that the next special procedure she has to perform is on you. And then she does perform it. But don't worry. Unlike the others, you'll wake up afterwards, and then we'll be halfway there, because you won't be in the database anymore, except in the past tense.
Stan's getting a headache. He can hardly follow this.
So that's what Charmaine's been doing at her confidential job. She's been...
He can't believe this.
Fluffy, upbeat Charmaine?
Fuck! She's a murderess!
Wait, you haven't told her? He says.
Charmaine? She'll think she's killed me?
For her, it has to be real, says Jocelyn. We don't want her to act. They'd see through it. They have facial expression analyzers. But Charmaine will believe the setup. She's really good at believing.
She enters readily into fantasies, says Phil.
Is that a grin?
Charmaine won't kill me, says Stan firmly. No matter how far into her you got, you lying dipshit.
He wants to say, but doesn't.
If she thinks it'll kill me, she won't go through with it.
We'll find that out too, won't we? Says Jocelyn, smiling.
Stan wants to say, Charmaine loves me.
But he's not completely sure of that anymore.
And what if there's a mistake? What if I really do die? He'd like to ask.
But he's too chicken shit to admit he's chicken shit. So he keeps quiet.
Phil starts the car, moves them soundlessly along the street toward Positron Prison. He turns on the dashboard radio. It's the Doris Day playlist.
You made me love you.
Stan relaxes.
That crooning voice is such a safe place for him now.
He closes his eyes.
Happy Valentine's Day, says Jocelyn softly.
She pats his thigh again.
He hardly even feels the needle go in. It's just a slight jab,
Then he's over the edge of the misty cliff. Then he's falling. Part 7. White Ceiling. White Ceiling. Stan enters consciousness as if coming up from a well full of dark molasses. No, a well with nothing in it, because he didn't have any dreams. The last thing he can recall is being in the car, the black surveillance car with darkened windows, with Jocelyn sitting beside him in the back seat and her smug, treacherous dipstick of a husband doing the driving. He has an image of the back of Phil's head, a head he wouldn't mind perforating with a broken bottle, and then another of Jocelyn putting her sturdy but manicured hand out to pat his knee in the patronizing way she had, as if he was a pet dog. The black sleeve of her suit. That was his last snapshot. Then the prick of the needle. He was gone before he knew it. But look, she didn't kill him. He's still in his body. He can hear his heart beating. As for his mind, it's clear as ice water. He doesn't feel drugged. He feels refreshed and hyper-alert, as if he's just chugged a couple of double espressos. He opens his eyes. Fuck. Nothing. Maybe he's been sent to the stratosphere after all. No, wait. It's a ceiling. A white ceiling with light reflecting down from it. He turns his head to see where the light's coming from. No, he doesn't turn his head, because his head won't turn that far. Something's restraining it, and his arms, and yes, his legs, too. Triple fuck. They've got him strapped down. Fuck, he says out loud. But no, he doesn't say that. The only sound that comes out of his mouth is a slobbering zombie sound. But urgent, like a car in a snowbank spinning its wheels. This is horrible. He can think, but he can't move, and he can't speak. Shit.
Charmaine hardly slept a wink all night. Maybe it was the screams. Or they might have been laughs. That would be nicer. Though, if they were laughs, they were loud, high, and hysterical. She'd like to ask some of the other women if they heard anything, too, but that's probably not a good idea. Or maybe her sleeplessness came from overexcitement. Because really, she's super excited. She's so excited she can only peck at her lunch. Because this afternoon, she gets to resume her real job. After putting in her morning session of towel folding, she got to throw away the shameful laundry room name tag and replace it with her rightful one, Chief Medications Administrator. It feels blissful, as if that name tag has been lost and now it's been found. Like when you misplace your scooter keys or your phone and they turn up and you get a rush of luckiness, as if the stars or fate or something has singled you out for a win. That's how happy her rightful name tag makes her feel. The other women in her section have noticed that name tag. They're treating her with new respect. They're looking at her directly instead of letting their eyes slide past her like she was furniture. They're asking her sociable questions, such as, how did she sleep, and isn't this an awesome lunch? They're handing her small, chatty praises, like what a good job she's doing with the blue teddy bears, even though she's such a crappy knitter. And they're smiling at her, not half smiles either, but full-on, total-face smiles that are only partly fake. It isn't at all hard for her to smile back. Not like the past weeks, when she was exiled to towel folding, when she felt so lonely and isolated, and her own smile felt cracked, as if there was a broken cement sidewalk right behind her teeth, and her mouth felt shrunken and clogged. And the other women spoke to her in sentences of two words because they didn't know what kind of disgrace she was in. Charmaine couldn't blame them, since she didn't know that herself. She tried her utmost to believe it was just a trivial mistake. You always had to try your utmost to believe the positive. Because what did believing the negative ever get you except depressed? Whereas with the positive, you found the strength to carry on. And she had carried on. Though it had been hard. Because she'd been so scared. What were they really planning for her? She's sure there's more than one of them. The only one they actually show much of is Ed. But there has to be a whole bunch of them behind the scenes, talking everything over and making important decisions. Have they been sitting in their boardroom, discussing her? Do they know she's been cheating on Stan? Have they got photos of her, or voice recordings, or even worse, videos? She'd said that to Max once. What if there's a video? But he'd only laughed and said, why would there be a video cam in an abandoned house? And he only wished there was so he could relive the moment. But what if he has been reliving the moment? And those other men have been reliving it too. It makes her blush all over to think of them watching her and Max in those vacant houses. She wasn't herself with Max. She was some other person. Some slutty blonde she wouldn't speak to if they were standing in a checkout line together. If that other Charmaine tried to strike up a conversation with her, she'd turn away as if she hadn't heard. Because you're known by the company you keep, and that other Charmaine is bad company. But that Charmaine has been banished, and she herself, the real Charmaine, has been restored to good standing, and she has to keep it that way no matter what. She gazes down the table at the rows of women in their orange boiler suits. She doesn't know them very well, because they've basically not been speaking to her, but their faces are familiar. She scans their features as they chew away at their lunches. Isn't this a warm, fuzzy, grateful feeling she's getting? Because each one of them is a unique and irreplaceable human being? No, this is not a warm, fuzzy, grateful feeling. To be honest, she doesn't like these women much. Grandma Wynne would say she wouldn't trust any of them as far as she could throw them, which isn't very far since most of them are overweight. They should burn more energy. Take the dancer size classes or work out in the Positron gym. Because sitting on their fat butts knitting those stupid blue bears, plus eating the desserts is piling the pounds onto them and they're blowing up like blimps. And deep down, she doesn't give a crap about each of them being a unique and irreplaceable human being. Because they didn't treat her like one. They treated her like something that got stuck on their shoe. But that's the past. And she must not look back in anger or hold on to grudges because such behavior is toxic, as the girl in the pink outfit says on the TV yoga show. So now she's dwelling on blessings. How blessed they all are to be tucked in here when so many other people are having a bad time outside the wall, where, according to Ed, everything's going to rat shit. Even more rat shit than it was going to when she lived out there. The lunch is chicken salad. It's made with chickens raised right here at Positron Prison in healthy and considerate surroundings over at the men's wing. And the lettuce and arugula and radicchio and celery are grown here as well. Though not the celery, now that she thinks of it. That comes in from outside. But the parsley's grown here, and the spring onions, and the Tiny Tim tomatoes. Despite her lack of appetite, she picks away at the salad. Because she doesn't want to look ungrateful. Or, worse, unstable. Here comes the dessert. They've set it out on the table at the far end of the room. The women get up in order, row by row, and stand in line for it. Plum crumble, the women murmur to one another, made with red plums from Positron's very own orchard. Though Charmaine has never worked in that orchard herself, or even talked to anybody who's worked in it, so how would she know if it even exists? They could be bringing those plums in here in cans, and nobody but whoever opens the cans would be any the wiser. These skeptical notions about Positron are coming to her more frequently. Don't be so stupid, Charmaine, she tells herself. Change the channel, because why would you even care about where the plums come from? And if they want to fib about plums to make us all feel better, what's the harm? She picks up her helping of plum crumble in its sturdy pressed glass dish. There's cream added, from Positron's own cows. Not that she's ever seen those cows, either. She nods and smiles at the other women as she files past them, sits back down at her place, stares at her crumble. She can't help thinking it looks like curdled blood. But she draws a marker across that thought, blacks it out. She should try to eat just a bit. It might steady her nerves. She's been away from the medication's administration job so long. Maybe she's lost her touch. What if she makes a shambles of the special procedure the next time she does it? Gets cold feet. Misses the sweet spot in the vein. When you're actually doing the procedure, you don't have big picture worries. You exist in the moment. You only want to get it right and do your duty. But over the past 2 months, she's been at a distance. And from a distance, what she does in medications administration doesn't always look the same as what she ought to do. Supposing she was just a person. "Are you having qualms, Charmaine?" asks the little voice in her head. "No, silly," she answers. "I'm having dessert. Plum crumble." The women at her table are making mmm sounds. Red crumbs cling to their lips.
Hood. Stan tries again. He uses all his strength, pushing up with his arms and thighs against the straps. They must be straps, though he can't see them. No dice. What is this? Jocelyn's warped idea of another kinky sex game? Charmaine, he tries to call. His throat slurs. His tongue is like a cold beef sandwich. Why is he calling her anyway? As if he can't find his socks? As if he needs help with his top shirt button? What kind of a help-me-mommy-wife whine is that? Maybe part of his brain is dead. Dumbass, he tells himself. Charmaine can't hear you. She isn't in the room. Or not so far as he can see, which isn't far. Oh, Charmaine. I love you, baby. Get me out of this. Wait a minute. Now he remembers. According to Jocelyn, Charmaine is supposed to kill him.
2 o'clock. The first procedure of the afternoon is scheduled for 3. After leaving the dining area, Charmaine heads back to her cell to spend a little quiet time alone. She needs to prepare herself, both physically and mentally, and also spiritually, of course. Do some deep breathing, the way they show it on TV. Fix her makeup, which is energizing. Calmness, positive energy. That's what she needs. But when she opens the door to her cell, there's someone already in it. It's a woman, in the standard orange boiler suit but with a hood over her head. She's sitting on the bed. Her wrists are attached together in front with plastic handcuffs. "Excuse me?" says Charmaine. If it weren't for the hood and the cuffs, she would have pointed out that this is her cell, and as far as she knows, there hasn't been a new cell assignment. And then she would have said, "Please leave."
"Don't,"
says the woman's voice, muffled by the hood. Then there's something else that Charmaine doesn't catch. She goes over to the bed. Risky, because what if this is a maniac who might snap at her or something? And lifts the hood up and back. This is a shock. This is definitely a shock. It's Sandy. It can't be Sandy. Why would it be Sandy? She stares at Charmaine with watery, blinking eyes.
"Charmaine Christ," she says. "Put the hood back on. Don't talk to me."
Charmaine is confused. Sandy never did bad things, apart from the hooking. But that was instead of a job, so why would she need to do it in consilience? Her hair is a wreck. Her cheekbones are more prominent than they were. Maybe she's had work done. Has she maybe been pushing? Talking to a journalist? But how? Sandy, what are you doing in my cell? She says. That doesn't sound very gracious, but it's not as if she meant it meanly. Sandy's leg is chained to the bed frame. Her ankles are shackled. This is serious.
Don't talk loud, Sandy whispers. They must have fucked up, stuck me in the wrong place. Pretend you don't know me, or you might get in trouble.
Are you a criminal element? Charmaine asks. Has to ask, though maybe she shouldn't. Sandy's a nice girl at heart. She can't be a criminal element. And anyway, the criminal elements she's used to dealing with at Medications Administration have all been men. She can't see Sandy murdering anyone or doing any of the other things that get you strapped down five ways on a gurney. What did you do? I mean, did you do anything?
I tried to get out, Sandy whispers. I tried to get myself smuggled through the wall in a bag of trash, where they sent it down that chute to the truck outside. I had sex with one of those trash guys, the ones in the green vests, you know the ones. He ratted on me, but not until after the sex, the fucker.
But, honey, why would you want to get out? Charmaine whispers. That's mystifying to her. It's so much better.
Yeah, it was at first. It was going great. I was helping at the gym, and then they picked me to make those yoga videos. I got some work done, cheekbones mostly, and they did the makeup, and all I had to do was put on that pink suit and read the script and do a few poses.
I thought it was you, Charmaine says untruthfully. You were great. It looked like you were an expert. She's a little jealous. What an easy job. And with star power, too. Not like her own job. But hers is more important.
So then Veronica came back one day, Sandy whispers. We were sharing a condo. She was training at the prison hospital, and she was all excited. They'd offered her a promotion to this special unit they have there.
What was it? Charmaine says. Maybe something bland, like pediatric.
It was in Medications Administration, says Sandy. She went the next day to start the training, but when she came back, she was upset. Veronica never gets upset normally.
Sandy pauses.
You mind scratching my back?
Charmaine scratches.
A little to the left, says Sandy. Thanks. So she said, basically, they want me to kill people. Underneath all the bullshit, that's what it is.
Oh, gosh, says Charmaine. Not really.
No shit, says Sandy. So she told them no, she couldn't do it. And the next day, she was gone. Just gone. Nobody knew where she went, or else they wouldn't say. I asked at her work, and they looked at me in this weird way and said that information was not available. It was creepy. So I wanted out.
You're not allowed out, Charmaine whispers. Remember what we signed? Couldn't you just explain to them?
She knows this is futile, because rules are rules. But she wants to hold out hope. Forget it, says Sandy. I'm fucked.
Her teeth are chattering.
No free lunch for me. I should have known. Now you need to put the hood back on and call a guard and say, why is this person in your cell? And they'll clear me out of your way.
But I can't just, says Charmaine. What will happen to you? She's going to cry. This is wrong. It has to be wrong. The chains, the handcuffs. Maybe they'll only put Sandy in towel folding or something. But she can't get herself to believe that. There's a dark light rippling around Sandy, like dirty water. Charmaine puts her arms around her. She's so cold. Oh, Sandy, she says. It will be okay.
Just do it, says Sandy. You don't have the choice.
Cherry Pie. The white ceiling is even more boring than Consilience TV. Hardly anything's going on up there.
though there has been a fly which has helped to pass the time. Scram fly. Stan thought at it, to see if he could control it by broadcasting his mental electrical waves. But he couldn't. The other thing on the white ceiling is a small, round silver circle. It's either a sprinkler or a video cam. He closes his eyes, then opens them. He should stay awake if possible. He concentrates on the chain of causes and effects and lies and impostures, some of them his, that has stranded him in this tedious or possibly terrifying cul-de-sac, which will terminate with Charmaine in a lab coat walking in here in about 5 minutes. Or at least he hopes it's that soon, because he really needs a piss. The poor mouse will think she's about to send some serial killer or child murderer or old person batterer to the next life. But when she approaches the gurney he strapped onto, it won't be an unknown criminal element waiting for her. It will be him. What will she do then? Scream and run away? Throw herself onto his body? Tell Positron there's been a terrible mistake? Maybe she'll flick a hidden switch to turn off the video cam, then unstrap him, and they'll hug each other, and she'll whisper, "I'm so sorry. Can you ever forgive me for cheating? You're the one I really love." And so on, though there won't be time for the drawn-out groveling and cringing he has the right to expect. But he'll squeeze her reassuringly, and then she'll show him what? A trap door? A secret tunnel? A set of clothes to wear as a disguise? He's watched way too much TV over the years. On TV, there are last-minute escapes and tunnels and trap doors. This is real life, numbnuts, he tells himself. Or it's supposed to be. But there has to be some last-minute plot flip like that, because Charmaine would surely never stick the death drug into him, or whatever it is she does. She'd never go the whole hog. She's too tender-hearted. He says to the ceiling, because now he's not so sure about her tender-heartedness. He's not sure of anything. And what if something has fucked up? And the positron spooks have caught up with double-dealing Jocelyn and arrested her, or maybe even shot her. And what if, when the door opens, it isn't Charmaine who walks through it? They're probably watching him right now through that silver circle. They've probably tortured Jocelyn, made her cough up her entire subversive plan. They probably think he's in on it. "I didn't know. It wasn't me. I've done nothing," he screams in his head. Shit. He's wet his pants. But it doesn't seep. It doesn't trickle. Have they got him in diapers? Crap. Not a good sign. So he can't be the first person who's been here and done the pant-wetting thing. You can't say they don't cover the angles.
It takes Charmaine a while to regain her calm after the two guards have hauled Sandy away. By the armpits, because she couldn't walk very well, what with the shackles.
"No need to mention this to anyone,"
the first guard had said. The second one gave a kind of barky laugh. Neither of them was anyone Charmaine had ever seen before. She takes some yogic breaths. She clears her mind of negative vibrations. Then she washes her hands, and after that she brushes her teeth. It's like a cleansing ritual, because she likes to feel pure in heart when going into a procedure. She checks herself in the mirror. There she is, the same sweet, roundish baby face she's always relied on at home and school. She hasn't changed that much since being a teenager, though she's a little dark under the eyes. She pulls a few strands of her blonde hair forward to frame her face. But she's thinner. She's lost weight over the past while. Slightly too much weight, and she's looking pale. She's been so worried. And she's still worried because even though her name's been cleared and she has her job again, what will the future bring? Once she's back at the house? The very worst, well, almost the worst, would be if they told Stan about Max.
Then what will happen when she sees Stan? He'll be really mad at her. Even if she cries and says she's sorry, and how can he ever forgive her, and he's the one she really loves, he still might want a divorce. The mere possibility makes her tearful. She'd feel so unsafe without Stan, and people would gossip about her, and she'd be all alone in Consilience forever, because you can't get out. But she might not feel very safe with Stan either. As for Max, yes, she does remember hoping he might leave his wife for her so they could be together, and she could be crushed in his embrace like a stepped-on blueberry muffin every minute of every day. He'd say, "There's no one like you. Bend over," while nibbling on her ear, and she'd melt like toffee in the sun. But on some level, she's always known that would be impossible. She's been a distraction for him, but not a necessity of life. More like a super strong mint, intense while it lasted, but quickly finished. And, to be fair, he's been the same thing for her. And if he was offered to her on a serving platter in exchange for Stan, she would say no thanks, because she could never depend on Max. He's too fast with his mouth. He's like a TV ad, pushing something dark and delicious but bad for you. Instead, she would say, "I choose Stan." She does feel quite certain that this is the choice she would make. But what if Stan rejects her, despite her new virtuous intentions? What if he throws her out, tosses her clothes onto the lawn for everyone to see, and then locks the door on the inside? Maybe it will happen at night, and she'll be outside in the rain, scratching on the window like a cat, begging to be taken back. "Oh, I've ruined everything," she'll wail. Her eyes water up just picturing it. But she'll refuse to think about that, because you make your own reality out of your attitude. And if she thinks about it happening, then it will. Instead, she'll think about Stan's arms going around her and him saying how miserable he's been without her and how happy he is that they're finally together once more. And she'll stroke him and cuddle him, and it will be like old times. Because the days will fly past and it will be switchover in a couple of weeks, and she can finally leave Positron for her month as a civilian again. She'll be working at her Consilience job in the bakery, and she won't have to think about screams or women with hoods chained to her bed. And she'll smell like cinnamon from the cinnamon buns. Such a cheerful smell. And not like the floral scent of the fabric softener from towel folding in Positron, which if you have to breathe it all day is truly chemical and sickly. She won't use that fabric softener on her own laundry anymore, ever. She'll be back in her own house with her pretty sheets and the bright kitchen where she cooks such nice breakfasts. And she'll be with Stan, because why would they even tell him about Max, supposing they know? Considering that the whole point of Consilience is for things to run smoothly, with happy citizens? Or are they inmates? Both, to be honest. Because citizens were always a bit like inmates, and inmates were always a bit like citizens. So Consilience and Positron have only made it official. Anyway, the point is the greatest happiness all around. And telling Stan would mean less happiness. In fact, it would mean more misery. So they won't do it. Already she can picture, no, feel Stan's arms around her. And then the way he nuzzles the side of her neck and says things like, "Yum, cinnamon, how's my little bun?" Or he used to say things like that, comfort food kinds of things. Though he was slacking off lately, almost ever since she got tangled up with Max, come to think of it. But he'll say those things again, because he'll have missed her and worried about her. "How's my cherry pie?" Not like the things Max says, which are more like, "I'm going to turn you inside out. After this, you won't be able to crawl. Beg me for it." Stan maybe isn't the most... well, the most. The most of whatever you'd call Max. But Stan loves her, and she loves him.
She does, really. That thing with Max was only a blip. It was an animal episode. She'll have to stay away from Max in future. Though it might be hard, because Max is so passionate about her. He'll try to get her back, no question. But she'll have to put her fingers in her ears and grit her teeth and roll up her sleeves and resist temptation. Oh, why shouldn't a person have both? Says the voice in her head. I'm making an effort here, she answers. So shut up. She looks at her watch. 2:30. Half an hour to go. The waiting is the worst thing. She's never been so trembly before a procedure. She smiles her, I am a good person smile. The smile of an absent-minded angel with a childish lisp. That smile has seen her through many difficult places, or at least it has since she's been grown up. It's a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's a rock concert wristband. It's a universal security password, like being in a wheelchair. Who would question it? To give herself confidence, she applies blush all over her pale face, then a thin coat of mascara on the eyelashes. Nothing too overdone. Positron allows makeup in jail. In fact, it encourages makeup, because looking your best is good for morale. It's her duty to look her best. She's about to become the last thing some poor young man will see on this earth. That's a big responsibility. She doesn't take it lightly. Charmaine, Charmaine, whispers the small voice in her head. You are such a fraud. So are you, she tells it.
Head game. Stan must have drifted off, but he comes awake with a start. That fucking fly is walking all over his face, and he can't get at it. Fucking fly, he tries to say. Fur, fur. Nope. No speech functions so far. Drugs got his tongue. He hopes this isn't permanent. He won't be able to buy anything except with little notes. Hi, my name is Stan, and I can't talk. Give me 10 bottles of booze. He won't care what kind. He'd drink elephant piss. After what he's been through, he'll want to get falling down blind drunk. Oblivious. It will make a good story, though, once he gets out. Once he hooks up with Brother Connor and his band of merry men and erases himself from the radar of everyone and everything to do with Positron. Because what rule is there that says he has to be Jocelyn's flunky and mule boy once he's out? Let her handle her own weird shit. He'll have to get Charmaine out too, of course. Maybe. If possible. Now the fly's trying to get into his eye. Blink, blink, turn the head. It's not very scared of eyelashes, but it moves. Now it's going into his nose. At least he has some control over his nostrils. He blows it out. His back is terminally itchy. He has a cramp in his leg. His diaper is sodden. More than anything, he wants this to be over. This stage, this phase, this powerlessness, whatever it is. Let's get this show on the road, he'd shout, if he were capable of shouting. Which he isn't. But he hopes he will be soon. He has a lot of shouting to catch up on.
Charmaine makes her way through the familiar corridors to the Medications Administration reception area, where 3 corridors come together. She's wearing her green smock over her orange boiler suit. Her latex gloves are in her pocket, as well as her face mask in case of germs. She'll put it on before she goes into the room. That's the rule. But then she'll take it off again. Because why should anyone's last view of a human face be so impersonal? She wants whoever it is to be able to see her reassuring smile. She's a little nervous. Probably they're monitoring it, this nervousness of hers. And most likely it counts in her favor because during the training course she took, they'd put some electrodes on you and then showed you pictures of people undergoing the special procedure and measured how you reacted. What they were looking for was a certain amount of jitteriness, but not so much that you'd lose control. They weeded out the ones who stayed totally calm and cold, and also those who'd showed too much eagerness. They didn't want people who got pleasure out of doing this. They didn't want sadists or psychopaths. In fact, it was the sadists and psychopaths who needed to be not euthanized, not erased. Those words are too blunt. Relocated to a different sphere, because they were not suited to the life of consilience. Maybe that's what will happen to Sandy, but in a nicer way. Maybe they'll just take her someplace else, like an island, with the other people on it who are like her. People who don't fit in, but not criminal elements. Surely that's what they'll do. Now she's reached reception, and there's the check-in box with the flat screen on the front. The head is already there. It must be expecting her. Today it's the woman with the dark hair and bangs. It's the same woman who was with Ed when he'd visited the knitting circle the night before. The one with the hoop earrings and the gray stockings. Someone important. Charmaine feels a slight chill. Yogic breath, she tells herself. In through the nose, out through the mouth. The head smiles at her. Is it only a recorded image this time? Or is it a real person? Could I have the key, please? Charmaine asks it, as she is supposed to. Log in, please, the head says to her. It's still smiling, though it seems to be looking at her more intently than usual. Charmaine presses her thumb to the pad, then gazes at the iris reader until it blinks. Thank you, says the head. The plastic key slides out of the slot at the bottom of the box. Charmaine puts it into her lab coat pocket, waits for the slip of paper with the details of the procedure printed on it. Room number, name, age, last dose of sedative, and when administered. It's necessary to know how alert the subject may be. Nothing happens. The head is staring at her with a meaningful half-smile. Now what? Thinks Charmaine. Don't tell me the dreaded data bank has messed up my identity numbers again. I need the procedure slip, she says to the head. Even if it's only a canned image, her request will surely register. Charmaine, the head says to her, we need to talk. Charmaine feels the hair stand up on the back of her neck. The head knows her name. It's talking to her directly. It's as if the sofa has spoken. What? She says. What did I do wrong?
You didn't do anything wrong, the head says, yet. But you're on probation. You must undergo a test.
What do you mean, probation? Says Charmaine. I've always been good at this job. I've never had any complaints. My job assessment score has been... She's twisting the latex glove in her right-hand pocket. She tells herself to stop. It's bad to show agitation, as if she's in some way guilty. She's up for their darn test, whatever it is. She's willing to bet her technique and fulfillment against anybody's. They can't fault her, except for not wearing her face mask, but who in their right mind would care about that?
It's not your competence that's in question, says the head. But management has had some misgivings about your professional dedication.
I've always been extremely dedicated, Charmaine says. Somebody must have been gossiping about her, telling lies. You have to be dedicated to do this job. Who says I haven't been dedicated? It must be that sneaky Aurora from Human Resources. Or someone in her knitting group. Because she wasn't peppy enough about those darn blue bears. I love my job. I mean, I don't love having to do what I do, but I know it's my duty to do it because it has to be done by someone, and I've always taken the best care and been very meticulous and...
Let's call it loyalty, says the head.
Why did the head say loyalty? Is loyalty about her and Max? I've always been loyal, she says. Her voice sounds weak.
It's a matter of degree,
says the head.
Please pay attention. You must carry out the procedure as usual today. It is very important that you complete the task that has been assigned to you.
I always complete the task,